Hello. Yes, electrodynamics. That's what we want to hear. And the technology is working. So, we worked out last time how if you see a particle moving at a certain velocity U prime in one reference frame, traveling to the right relative to reference frame K at velocity V, then the components of the parallel and perpendicular velocities as seen in reference frame K will be different, and these are the Einstein velocity addition formulas. These have some interesting properties. I should just quickly summarize. Of course, when U prime and V are much less than the speed of light, then we recover U is equal to U prime plus V. The Galilean result, Galilean relativity for non-relativistic motion. But if either U prime, this starts to approach the speed of light, or the relative velocity between the frames starts to approach the speed of light, then U will also approach the speed of light. But an important point about all this is that velocities, ordinary velocity, the rate of change of position with time, it does not obey Lorentz transformation.
You will obey.
Sorry, doesn't work. But what's interesting is you can define a quantity that does to transform. It's related to velocity that we'll call the four velocity that does transform exactly like a Lorentz transformation. But before I come to that, I want to set up some terminology that relates to causality, and in particular the terms space-like versus time-like separations between events versus light-like. And so what we're thinking about here is two events that happened, okay? So imagine two events. Call one happening at time TA in some reference frame and position XA, and the second event P of TB at position XB, to explosions or something. Okay. So there you can form a squared invariant interval between the two events. This will be a number that's the same in every inertial reference frame. Call that SAB squared, which is C squared times the difference in the times. Here again, everything I'm talking about has been measured in one reference frame, minus the spatial distance between them. Okay. And we could also write that in our relativistic notation as the four vector difference squared, which you'll recall involves the minus sign for the space part. Or we could also call this C squared delta T squared, the time difference squared minus the spatial distance squared, R squared. Okay. So there are three cases that have their own terminology. The first case is if this squared invariant interval is a positive number, which you can see means that the magnitude of C delta T is greater than the distance between them. Okay. And what this basically means is light would have time to get past R, past that distance R, in the time delta T. And because of that, there will be some velocity less than the speed of light, which could cover those two distances, okay? So that means there exists an inertial frame where these where these two events occur at the same position. Okay. And that means the difference of the four vectors xA minus xB will have only a time component and vanishing spatial separation. Okay. And for that case, we call this a purely time-like separation between these events. Okay. Right, because x naught prime is C times delta T prime, and that's only involves the time. There is a reference frame where it's only different in time. And this is easy to prove. You can imagine aligning our x-axis with the vector r between them. And then xab prime will be gamma times xab minus vt. And so to find the frame where xab prime is zero, right, we'll have to have r, the magnitude of xab, be equal to v. T, V delta T, really. And that's possible since CT is less than R. Okay. So that's for time-like events, first category. The second case is if SAB squared, our invariant interval, is negative. That means absolute value of C delta T is less than the distance between the two events in the reference frame we've chosen, right? Which again, R is the magnitude of what I'm calling the vector XAB. And so now we will find a reference, can find an inertial frame where the time difference is zero. And that is to say where XA prime minus XB prime looks like zero in the time component and as some spatial separation. And then we say that this separation of these two events in our four-dimensional world is purely space-like. It has no time difference. There's no time interval in this one, in this reference frame. And again, this is easy to prove. We just set x naught prime to be gamma x naught minus beta r. And so to demand that x naught prime be zero, we'll have to have x naught is equal to beta r, which means C delta T is equal to V over CR. And since C delta T is less than R, that means beta V over C just has to be less than 1, so we know this can be chosen. Okay, so that is the space-like case. And then there is the light-like case, third case. So now let's say the invariant interval, invariant squared interval, is equal to zero. That means we have a light-like separation of events right? Because these two events could only be connected by light, traveling at exactly the speed of light. Now these, as you can imagine, these tie into the notions of causality here. So let's talk about that. So basically, the reason we make these distinctions between the three possible things is to see what, you know, where in time and space can one event influence another event. Okay. So basically, two events with a space-like separation cannot be causally related. because basically this would require faster than the speed of light communication. And the world picture in a two-dimensional cut of four-dimensional space-time is a popular way to represent this, namely to put time on the vertical axis, except multiply by the speed of light, and then have any position coordinate. Right, so then we can draw on this graph the light-like lines that have a slope equal to one in these units, where CT, x is equal to CT or minus CT, right? And so if we imagine basically a particle at the origin at position 0 at time t equals 0, then it could only be, we can separate out the region between the axes from those outside. The region that's not hatched is the time-like region. In the past and the time-like future. And so if you imagine a particle moving through space, here's where it was in the past, it had to be somewhere here, and it got here, moving along, it got to time t equals 0, position 0, and at later time it will move forward in the time-like future of that particle. And so this line is called the world line of a particle's motion. And in terms of what this particle could affect in the future or could have been affected by in the past, this nicely delineates it, that only in the time-like past could it, anything happening here, influence the particle. And similarly, thinking of what this particle might do in the future, it can only influence things in the time-like future. Okay. And things like over here, it could have no influence on the particle, although I guess you could say that this will have its own world line, and so it might affect it up here in the future, where these regions have an overlap of their time-like regions. Okay, so that's some terminology. It's important for thinking about causality, and you see that these kind of diagrams a lot if you get into heavy relativity. Okay, so now let's come back to two new concepts, proper time and the four velocity. So, as I said before, the velocity transformation formula is not obeying a Lorentz transformation. And there's a simple reason why ordinary velocity does not transform by Lorentz. And essentially, it's because velocity, it's a ratio between the spatial components of a four vector and the time-like component of a four vector. But if we took a four vector and divided it by an invariant under Lorentz transformations, that would be another four vector. And in particular, if we divide the four vector of position and time, by the four vector of proper time, this will be a quantity like velocity. Okay, so what is this proper time? So one way to think about proper time is to consider an invariant displacement between two infinitesimally separated events. Let's write it as ds squared, which you recall in our contravariant covariant contraction notation, we can write like this. This is an invariant, and it's equal to c squared dt squared minus dx squared, involving both the time, infinitesimal time displacement and infinitesimal space displacement. Okay. And if we go in the instantaneous rest frame of the particle, right, particle's moving along on its trajectory, if we stay in its locally inertial reference frame, then of course there's no separation between any event that it sees along its trajectory. By definition, we are in instantaneously its rest frame. And so in that reference frame, there's no position part. This is only c squared. Let's call that reference frame the primed frame. It's going to be just c squared dt prime squared. But this dt prime is in fact simply the proper time between these two events. Right, being at position x and time t, and infinitesimally later being at t plus dt and position x plus dx. And so, because this is a so special reference frame, this one preferred reference frame from the particle's point of view, this is what's called the proper time, and it's given the separate symbol tau, d tau, is the proper time between time t and t prime and t prime plus dt prime. So in other words, ds squared could always be written as c squared d tau squared. And that will be the same number in every reference frame. And of course, if we want then to write d tau in terms of dt in any other frame, that will simply be dt is going to be time dilated by the factor gamma for going to that frame at some velocity v relative to the rest frame of the particle. So again, dt then will be the time interval in, say, in K, reference frame K. And there's another way of thinking about this. It's written in the notes, but I don't think I'll go through that. But you might want to read that. But that brings us to the idea of the definition of the four velocity based on these ideas. Which is this velocity-like quantity that obeys a Lorentz transformation. In particular, we will define this U, its contravariant components, as the derivative of the time position covariant components of a particle, its position time. Time position 4 vector, instead of differentiating with respect to t, we differentiate with respect to the invariant d tau. And this, now we know, transforms as a 4 vector just by the argument I gave earlier. Any 4 vector divided by an invariant will be a 4 vector. Okay. So now this, we know how to transform the time position 4 vector. That exact same matrix transformation now applies to this quantity. Okay. So let's give a little bit of interpretation to all this. So x alpha, remember, means contravariant components are the c times t and the position of the particle. And the space part of this new 4 vector trying to be consistent with my notation. I'll try to write this just as a U is now write the space part with is the 4 vector except with an arrow over it, right? And that is d derivative of the position space part divided by tau. And so that is in a reference frame, some inertial reference frame, this will be gamma associated with the particle velocity as seen in reference frame K times the ordinary velocity as seen in that frame. So the space parts of our four, this quantity I'm calling the four velocity, right, is gamma u times the ordinary velocity, lowercase u. But so this is the quantity we're normally interested in thinking about when we think about velocity. But we have a four vector, and it has a time component also. So let's look at the time component of our new four vector. That will be u0, which is dx0 d tau. And that is, as seen in some reference frame, C times gamma associated with the velocity of the particle as measured in frame K times dt dt, which is 1. So the time part of our velocity for our four velocity is just the speed of light times gamma in any frame moving at velocity u relative to the instantaneous reference frame of the particle. Okay, so again, gamma u, when I put a subscript on it, because we're going to have a lot of velocities floating around, again, this means the gamma associated with this velocity in the subscript. So I'm trying to be consistent, use this capital letter to always indicate the four velocity and the lowercase to indicate the ordinary velocity. Okay, so that is our four velocity. That brings us to section 11.5 about energy and momentum. Of a particle in motion. And so the goal of this discussion is, because I realize you all learned this as in undergraduates, but I think it's kind of helpful to review it and try to go through the argument. Where did this relativistic energy and momentum come from? So I'm going to start, like I like to do in this whole course, start at the beginning. And let's first of all phrase our goal in this. Like, imagine we don't know everything from Einstein yet, but you already all know it. But let's pretend we don't know it. Okay, so what we're going to try to do is find relativistic generalizations of both the non-relativistic concept, momentum is mass times velocity, and K kinetic energy is 1/2 mass times velocity squared. Okay, so the hope, again, starting out, imagine Einstein thinking this through, is that, first of all, the new generalizations will give the old conservation laws at low velocity. If u is much less than the speed of light. And secondly, we hope that we can identify new quantities that will be conserved even in relativity, like in a collision at high velocities. So the argument we're going to pursue, we'll start by looking at a non-relativistic two-body collision in one reference frame. So let's look at the non-relativistic momentum conservation law for such a collision. Let's pick a one-dimensional collision in one reference frame. I guess I'm calling it K prime. Okay, so we have some particle 1 moving at velocity u1 prime along our 1D axis. It's going to collide with second particle with its velocity u2 prime. And after the collision, the particles might have changed. And particle 3 comes out of the collision with its velocity u3 prime, and particle 4 comes out with its velocity u4 prime. And so in K prime, we expect the following equality, because we know momentum is conserved absolutely in the absence of external fields. M1 mass particle 1 times u1 prime plus mass particle 2 u2 prime equals mass of particle 3 u3 prime plus mass of particle 4 u4 prime. And again, these could be different particles because it might have been a reaction like, you know, AB plus CD goes to AC plus BD, for instance, as happens in nuclear physics and chemical physics all the time. So all that we know from non-relativistic momentum conservation. But now let's look at that in from the point of view of a different reference frame, that exact same collision. So that means Lorentz transformed this to reference frame K, which is moving at minus V relative to K prime, Right, so we have the same setup we had when we derived the Lorentz transformation, that we have reference k, and then we have k prime moving to the right at velocity v relative to k. Okay, so this, after doing the Einstein velocity addition formula, should say m1 times v plus u1 prime over 1 plus v u1 prime over c squared plus m2 v plus u2 prime over 1 plus v u2 prime over c squared would equal m3 if this were the correct velocity or momentum conservation law. This would equal then v plus u3 prime over 1 plus v u3 prime over c squared plus m4 v plus u4 prime over 1 plus v u4 prime over c squared. Okay. But when you see this, it's pretty hard to see how this could happen, and in fact it doesn't happen. This is an untrue equation, which tells us that having this quantity conserved in one frame means it wouldn't appear to be conserved in another frame. Okay. So what would the momentum conservation law look like? The non-relativistic momentum conservation law in frame K it would read M1, of course, times, now do the Galilean transformation of velocities, V plus U1 prime plus M2 V plus U2 prime would equal m3 times v plus u3 prime plus m4 v plus u4 prime. Okay. And this equation does hold non-relativistically because these mass factors all combine into a separate equation, m1 plus m2 equals m3 plus m4, which is true because mass is conserved in Galilean relativity. Which, of course, we'll see is not true relativistically. Okay, so what we want is to find a quantity which, if it is conserved in one frame, it will be conserved in every inertial reference frame. That's, of course, what we want. If we don't have that, we won't have any useful conservation law. So let's attempt instead to define a relativistic momentum in terms of the velocity four vector, the four velocity. So let's try to set P, the four velocity, to be the mass times the spatial part of the four velocity, of the four velocity, mass times four velocity, which you recall is gamma. We're looking at this all in one reference frame where the particle is moving at speed u, then this gamma u would multiply the mass of the particle times its ordinary velocity. And again, the gamma u means 1 minus u squared over c squared to the minus a half. And the logic is that if momentum adds up and is conserved in one frame, it would automatically be conserved in all reference frames, since the Lorentz transformation is linear. Okay, so let's look at this hypothesis. Okay, let's consider a collision in frame K prime. Okay, and let's hypothesize that this quantity talking about the x component, okay, so we're just, again, talking about this 1D motion. So that's what the subscript 1 represents, and in parentheses is the particle number, okay. And then the m1 u1 prime of 1 plus m2 u1 prime for particle 2 should hypothetically be equal, if momentum, if this is a quantity conserved, this would equal m3 u1 prime for particle 3 plus m4 u1 prime for particle 4. Okay. And that's, again, the components of this relativistic momentum candidate along the x-axis, which is the one axis. And I guess in the notes I called that equation 1. Now we will carry out a Lorentz transformation to another reference frame. To reference frame K, where again K prime moves at beta, which is V over C relative to K. So K will move at minus V. I need new chalk. And this will involve, of course, the relative velocity gamma, gamma sub v, which is 1 minus beta squared to the minus 1 half. Okay. So we know for each particle, for each piece of velocity in that, coming in over there, right, before and or after the collision, we'll have these relations, u I'm not sure why I was writing these with covariant components instead of contravariant, probably because I had too many primes that would be confusing. So we'll stick with the covariant components, but the same formula would hold with the contravariant, of course. U naught would be then, just applying the Lorentz transformation, will be gamma V times U naught prime plus beta U1 prime, and U1 will be gamma V times U1 prime plus beta U0 prime. That'll apply to every term. So now the idea is we're going to see whether this equality will still hold, M1 U1 of 1 plus M2 U2 of 2, is that equal to M3 U1 component for particle 3 plus M4 U1 component for particle 4. Okay, so let me just plug in these relations everywhere. So this means M1 gamma V U1 prime of 1 plus beta U0 prime of 1 plus M2 gamma V U1 prime of 2 plus beta, again that's beta V, U0 prime of 2 would equal then M3 gamma V times U1 prime of 3 plus beta U0 prime of 3 plus M4 gamma V U1 prime of 4 plus beta U naught prime of 4. Okay, which I called equation 2. And in fact, this will turn out to be true. Let me go ahead and erase the question mark. But let me show you why. So first of all, this has, part of this is just this equation 1, but multiplied every term by a gamma V. So that part of the equation holds, the part involving that, and that, and that, and that. But we are left with another condition out of that. Those remaining terms would have to be equal as well for that to be an equality. So an additional equality that we'd have to hold is that M1 U0 prime of 1 plus M2 U0 prime of 2 have to equal M3 U0 prime of 3 plus M4 U0 prime of 4. So this would seem to not say that mass is conserved in the collision, something else. And to understand what that might mean, let's look at the limit of low velocity and try to connect this to what we know there. So let's explore this. Consider the low V limit, the low U limit. Okay, so M1, for instance, U naught prime for particle 1, remember, is gamma of its velocity, I'll call gamma 1, times M1 times the speed of light. And again, gamma 1, 1 minus U prime of 1 squared over C squared, the minus a half. So in the low velocity limit, where its magnitude is much less than the speed of light, this goes to U naught prime of 1 goes to M1 times the speed of light. And so this quantity is consistent with mass conservation in the low velocity limit. But let's not stop there. Let's look at the next term in the applying the second rule of theoretical physics, do a Taylor expansion, and consider the next order correction. As the velocity starts to get closer to the speed of light, but is still relatively small. So M gamma, right, which is M times 1 minus U squared over C squared to the minus a half, will be M, my binomial expansion, 1 plus U squared over C squared, 2C squared, sorry, plus minus a half, minus 3 halves, U to the fourth over 2 factorial C squared plus dot, dot, dot. Okay. Which I can also write as 1 over C squared times MC squared. And the next term looks like 1 half M U squared, and the next term I has a typo in the notes. It's 3/8 m u to the fourth, and it should be c squared here instead of c fourth, and as it's written in the notes. Okay. So this is the term we said would reduce to mass conservation in the non-relativistic limit. And that next term, though, basically, this is the ordinary non-relativistic kinetic energy. So in other words, this term we had over here, you can say gamma mc squared goes in the low energy limit to mc squared plus the kinetic energy plus a correction term of order u to the fourth over c to the fourth. Yeah? Here it should be c to the fourth, but not here. Thanks. Okay, so this seems like this would all hold together, provided we interpret this as follows. mc squared, we'll call the rest energy of a particle when it's not moving. We will call gamma associated with the particle's velocity as measured in some reference frame. Mc squared is the total energy of a particle. And we will regard gamma minus 1 times mc squared as the kinetic energy of the particle. And this means that our newly defined candidate for momentum, relativistic momentum, will be conserved in a collision only if and only if this relativistic energy is also conserved in the collision. And so now we combine all this information into a new four-vector which is called either the four-momentum or the energy-momentum four-vector. Namely, its contravariant components of this four vector are mass just times the four velocity, four vector, which is m u naught for the particle, and the space part is the relativistic momentum according to this definition, mass times the four velocity, spatial part of the four velocity, which we could also write as E over the speed of light. If this total energy we call E, and the space part of the relativistic momentum. And again, E means this is a quantity in some chosen reference frame where we're going to look at the particle motion, the particle moving at velocity, ordinary velocity, lowercase u, times mc squared. That's the total velocity of one particle in any particular frame, in whatever frame we've chosen to look at it. Another useful relation about all this is that the ordinary velocity can be written as c times the relativistic momentum divided by the energy. Like if you ever have to do much with like relativistic beams at Fermilab or something like that, or CERN. Some of these formulas, this one and some others I'm about to write down, can be useful for doing relativistic kinematics and dynamics. in different reference frames. One useful quantity is to remember there will be an invariant length associated with any four vector. Which is its contraction with itself. P alpha, which is E squared over C squared minus P squared, right? That's a Lorentz invariant. Be the same number in every frame. And so in particular, you can calculate it in any convenient reference frame. So for instance, which you can often make use of, so for instance, in the particle rest frame, where P is 0 and gamma U is 1, then E is mc squared. And so P alpha contraction will just be m squared c squared. And then in any other frame, that will be equal to E squared over C squared minus P squared. And you often see this inverted in a different form, that the energy can also be related to kinetic energy, to momentum by this. And then similarly, T, kinetic energy, will be E minus mc squared, or gamma minus 1 mc squared. Okay, that's all I wanted to say about relativistic momentum energy conservation. So the next topic is sections 11.6 and 11.9, which I'll just get started on briefly today, setting up some things we'll talk mostly about next lecture. And this is about the idea of what's called covariance. So let me remind you what we've talked about with contravariant and covariant four vectors. So we've discussed contravariant four vectors. A superscript alpha, which has a time component and a space component, and covariant four vectors, we called them with a subscript A sub alpha, which is A sub zero minus the spatial part of the vector, and the contravariant and covariant components of the time-like part of the four vector are equal covariant equals contravariant. And we saw that these two types of representation of the same information are connected by the metric tensor. G alpha beta, which is this 1, minus 1, minus 1, minus 1 diagonal matrix. And this metric tensor has following properties, like G alpha beta contracted with G superscript gamma beta contracted on the gamma index is a Kronecker delta, delta alpha beta. And the contraction of this delta alpha beta with itself, which is right, is equal to 4, because you're adding up just the diagonal elements of this. And we can represent the Lorentz transformation as we saw. By a matrix transformation, a linear Lorentz transformation, to go between reference frames. X prime, a four vector in the primed frame, will equal this lambda superscript alpha subscript beta contracted with x beta superscript, and this lambda alpha beta we said was dx prime superscript alpha with differentiated with respect to x superscript beta. And if the relative velocity is along the x-axis, that is this matrix with hyperbolic cosine of the rapidity zeta minus hyperbolic cosine of zeta minus hyperbolic cosine of zeta, hyperbolic cosine of zeta, 0, 0, 0, 0. 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0. It's this matrix, which is maybe even simpler to write. Lambda alpha beta is gamma minus gamma beta minus gamma beta gamma 1, 1, and zeros everywhere else for boost along the x-axis. Some other relations are that lambda superscript alpha subscript beta is related by the metric tensor to g alpha eta contracted with lambda with both indices subscript, both indices covariant, eta beta contracted over eta. And that will also equal lambda alpha eta superscript times g eta beta. All those are equal. One thing I like to do whenever I encounter these kind of matrix multiplications, either matrix-matrix or matrix-vector, is I try to keep the indices adjacent in the quantities being multiplied. It's not always possible to do this, but when it's possible, this helps a lot to keep these adjacent indices appearing next to each other in the formula. just a notational suggestion. I have caught a lot of bugs in my computer programs by rigidly following that prescription. Oh, I've gone over time. I have to stop. Stop me. Stop me, please. Okay, we will continue marching through the tulip field of relativistic mechanics next time.